Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. As you know, listeners, we mostly, well, almost exclusively focus on U.S. politics, but not today. Today, we are setting our sights abroad on a string of recent elections with seemingly similar results. The success of nationalist and populist parties, generally on the right. Examples include Australia, the Philippines, India, and most recently, the European parliamentary elections. Various analyses have connected these elections, and you can see the line connecting them to Brexit and Trump's election or others as well. A recent Washington Post title reads, "The global far right is here to stay," and another from CNN reads, quote, "Elections in the EU and India tilt the world's largest democracies towards populism." So is there such a thing as a global political mood of sorts? Is it fair to connect all these different elections from different parts of the globe into some sort of pattern? And here with me to answer that question are two professors that regular listeners will be familiar with as our Brexit experts. David Runciman is the head of the Department of Politics and International Studies at the University of Cambridge. Hello, David.
Hi.
And Helen Thompson is a professor in the Cambridge Department of Politics and International Studies focusing on political economy. Hello, Helen.
Hi.
And they also host the podcast Talking Politics, which I highly recommend to anybody interested in global politics. Later on, we're also going to catch up on Brexit and Theresa May's departure. But let's begin with the bigger question. Helen and David, in looking at recent elections around the world, India, Australia, the Philippines, the European Union, do you see overarching themes there?
I have to say, I'm pretty skeptical about that. Obviously, you can point to some parties that look like they have something in common with each other that have done reasonably well in these elections. And you can certainly see that perhaps in the European Parliament elections. You've got a group of what gets called populist parties that did well in several countries, but certainly not all countries. You've got Green parties that did well in a number of European Union states in these European Parliament elections, but not others. But I have to say, I find it a stretch connecting what's gone on in Australia to what's gone on in India, and then to try and put what are general elections onto what's gone on in the European Parliament, because European Parliament elections have always been elections that have given small parties opportunities that they generally don't have at general elections. And I think you'd be hard pushed as well on the Australia case to turn, you know, what is basically the conventional centre-right party into some evidence of populism rising in Australia.
I would add to that, I think if there is a connection here, it's a negative one. You do see particularly parties of the centre-left, established parties, struggling pretty much everywhere, perhaps with the exception of the US Democrats. And you look at these elections around the world, and no one really in any of these countries has worked out how to, on the centre-left, how to get out of that mess. I mean, these parties are still very different. The Congress Party is obviously very different from the Australian Labour Party, which in its way is very different from European centre-left parties. But that mood, which is particularly seems rejectionist of a traditional centrist social democratic appeal through a traditional centrist social democratic party, there does seem to be something going on there and something that connects, as you put it, the mood, the rejectionist mood of electorates.
Okay, so Helen, you're not necessarily buying that there is at least a positive connection and that people are moving towards populism and nationalism. But David, you're suggesting that they may be moving away from center-left parties globally. Are the sources of, you know, Helen, you may disagree, but David, are the sources of that trend around the globe the same? Can you point to the same forces at play in the United States, in Britain, in the EU, in India and Australia as moving the country away from those center-left parties or even sometimes center-right parties?
I mean, I think it is one of the deep and, for now, not totally resolved questions of contemporary politics and political science. What does drive this and why center-left parties are at least potentially suffering more than center-right ones? But the difference is still, I think I'm with Helen, they stand out more than the similarities. You know, the rejection of kind of dynastic politics in India, the Congress Party and its particular history and its particular relationship, established and establishment relationship to the history of the Indian state, seems so different from what happened in Australia, which was in some respects a climate change election, but it was also an election where a brand of politics, which we discussed this on our podcast, sort of reminded us of British politics, but maybe 5-10 years ago, seemed to reach the end of the road in Australia. Some of the economic discontents are clearly shared across these different countries and certainly shared across parts of the European Union. But when you look at politics in these places, so much hangs on the history of these parties, the political systems they operate in, the way that voters in these countries actually associate them with particular points in their national histories. The collective trends, I think it's dangerous to assume it and to package it all up as the far right being on the march. I think that's a mistake.
Yeah, I think that there is certain commonality in a number of countries, and I would say the United States and a reasonable amount of the European Union, where immigration in different ways has had a disruptive, or attitudes towards immigration has had a disruptive impact on the traditional parties. And even then, you've got to separate that out because, you know, what went on in the United States in relation to Trump being able to first get the Republican nomination and then win was obviously bound up with the question in immigration terms of illegal immigration. And in the case of Britain and Brexit, the question was bound up with freedom of movement and its constitutional protection in the EU treaties. And they are pretty different kind of things. Nonetheless, I think it's reasonable to say that in a number of these countries, as say, at least Europe and the North American side, you can see immigration doing some of this work. I think it's also reasonable to say that centre-left coalitions in a number of countries, and I think you could bring Australia into this, are struggling with the divide within their old electoral coalition between working-class voters and the urban middle class, professional middle class in particular, whose interests and beliefs, perhaps more importantly, have diverged over a set of issues. And climate change, I think, showed that in a particular way in Australia, and Brexit is showing it in a very different kind of way in Britain. But we do need to be careful, I think, of overgeneralising. And I certainly think that when you start trying to bring India into this story, then we run into a considerable amount of difficulty.
Just to broaden it out even more, I mean, you see some of these analyses bringing in Israel and Brazil and Turkey and basically saying that there could be all kinds of potential forces at play, like globalization or climate change or like the financial crisis. So if you broaden it out even more and say, yes, there's this general move globally towards populism and nationalism, is there any value to that analysis, or is that basically bunk in your view?
I mean, it's not absurd. And in a way, it'd be ridiculous for us to sit here and say that when you look at global politics over the last 5 years, but actually particularly maybe over the last 18 months, that there aren't striking features that seem to connect up apparently disparate events. And there is an arc that runs from Bolsonaro through Trump, through Orban in Hungary, Erdogan, Modi, Duterte. You know, there is that arc which is in democratic or semi-democratic states tilting towards authoritarianism. And of course, the other thing that does connect them is it's not just that the electorates themselves may be being motivated by some of the same discontents, but these politicians are self-consciously themselves connecting with each other. They are mimicking each other. They are repeating the same tropes. I mean, in a way, the most obvious connection is not at the level of the electorates, at the level of the politicians that they elect. But the search for the single or unifying explanation that this is a planet on the verge of climate breakdown and it's manifesting as a resurgence of fascism, or this is a sign of a global economy at its limits and democracy is kind of bearing the strain of that. I think that level of analysis is more dangerous than it is helpful. And I think one of the temptations is just to assume that we know where this is going. And in each of these countries, it could radically diverge in the next 5 years. And the idea that this arc is a sort of historical arc in time, not just geographical, that's much, much more dangerous, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's some generalizations that can be made as long as we try and sort of group some countries together. So I think that you can say that there's a story about North American politics and European politics that is about the disruption that came from the fallout of 2008 in different ways. And in part, I think, in fact, I think in quite significant part, about a shift in the balance of power between the United States and Europe, which very much strengthened ultimately American power, and that Europe and the European Union were left with a set of difficulties with which they've struggled since. I think that when you get beyond, though, the countries that we might describe sometimes as the West, so North America and Europe, and you get into Australia and India, you get into difficulties in saying that there's some kind of systemic explanation that arises out of 2008. I mean, you know, the Australian economy hasn't had a recession, not just didn't have one in 2008, it hasn't had one for, I think I'm right in saying, more than a quarter of a century. So Australia is really quite distinctive in that respect. And India, it's had a set of macroeconomic problems in the last few years that you can connect, I think, to what's been going on globally in terms of Federal Reserve Board policy. But again, you know, India is not some... It didn't have a politics that was shaken to its foundations in any way by what happened in 2008. So I think that there are structural causes, but getting from structural causes to having global implications, I think, is a difficult part.
And just to say one more thing, the other potential obvious connector here is nationalism. Whether nationalism is a symptom or a cause is another question. But even the nationalisms are so different. The idea that Modi-style nationalism could be compared to Scott Morrison-style nationalism in Australia. And then even countries where people don't think politics is going wrong. So New Zealand is often held up. Jacinda Ardern is often held up as an example. The British press were always writing, if only she would come over here, she could sort out Brexit. She's the kind of empathetic politician that we need. But she achieved power in New Zealand by running what, by New Zealand standards, was a relatively nationalist form of centre-left politics. I mean, she did defend New Zealand first on some issues, including housing. And yet New Zealand is never included in this arc of authoritarianism, because it's not in the arc of authoritarianism, but it's very broadly in an arc of democratic politicians using soft nationalism to win elections. And so if you're going to really step back and stretch it, you actually probably have to include places that aren't normally thought to be part of the crisis.
Are there, in fact, counterexamples? Are there places in the world right now that are becoming more liberal or more global, less nationalist?
I don't know. Canada? Probably not. I'm looking at Helen.
I think you'd be hard-pushed, really, to say that German politics is becoming more nationalist. I mean, the AfD... You know, it had a bit of a surge, but it hasn't done anything in significant sense for the last, you know, like couple of years. It didn't do particularly well in the European Parliament elections. The CDU's been losing voters, its liberal voters, to the Greens.
And that's the thing. In a way, it's at least possible that the big story in the Euro elections, European Parliament elections, wasn't the success of the hard right or far right. In some respects, that faction may have slightly underperformed. It was the Greens. And no one could paint Green politics in Europe anyway as anything other than broadly internationalist. I mean, whether it's liberal is another question, because it does often require quite intense state intervention to get the kind of policies that they want. But it's definitely internationalist. And Green politics in Europe, and potentially even in the UK, is on a rising tide.
But I think even then you'd have to qualify it, because there were far more states where the Greens didn't get anywhere in these European Parliament elections than there were where they did. And they tended to be geographically concentrated on the western side of the European Union.
So in this sense, is it maybe fair to say that there's a rejection of established parties that comes with some sort of realignment? And also in that analysis, are there any historical examples? I mean, do we just from time to time realign, reconfigure ourselves politically on a global scale and move more towards the left or more towards the right, more towards globalism or more towards nationalism?
I think that even the rejectionist of mainstream parties outright story is hard to tell, because after all, in the Australian election, it wasn't that people didn't vote for the two main parties, or the two main parties, one is a coalition. They just didn't vote for them in the way was predicted by the opinion polls. And in a way, that election was more reminiscent of some elections we've had in the UK, for instance, the general election in 2015, where people were just surprised. They thought that the party of the centre-left was going to win, and it didn't. But it's not like people turned against that party. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Britain today, literally this morning, the first opinion poll in the history of opinion polling in this country, I don't know how far that goes back, but it's what it says.
1943.
So the first poll of no doubt tens, if not hundreds of thousands, in which neither the Labour Party nor the Conservative Party are in the top two. So the first time that has ever happened today.
Oh, wow.
Now, it may not last even tomorrow. And it's very close, but the Liberal Democrats were top, the Brexit Party were second, and Labour and the Conservatives were a couple of points behind, tied in third. Tomorrow it may shift. But that kind of thing in the UK context, there isn't a historical precedent for that. And again, if you look at Australia, I don't think that their electoral system is under enormous strain, and the centre-left party will have to find a way to reinvent itself. And if it does, it will probably win the next election. But our first-past-the-post version of politics, it can't really accommodate what's going on here, which is a kind of fragmentation. But it's being driven by Brexit. So there is no analogy anywhere else. The only reason the Brexit Party is polling ahead of Labour and the Conservatives is in the clue is in the name.
Yeah, I think if you go back to the 1990s, you can see sort of shifts that go across quite a number of countries that turn out to be quite significant. There's a shift in Europe and in the United States with the 1992 presidential election to centre-left. You know, centre-right parties did better in the 1980s. Centre-left parties generally did better in the 1990s. I'm not sure, though, that if you went back to sort of the periods of economic turbulence in those countries that had some version of, you know, like democratic politics before, or representative politics with a reasonable franchise before the First World War, say, where you have economic crises, you don't really have anything, I think, that looks like the American populists in the 1890s that appears in European politics. Now, you could say that's because you've got nascent social democratic parties in Europe and you haven't got that in the United States. That's, I suppose, a possible explanation of that. But, I mean, that is a period that's generally seen as, if sometimes like gets called like part of the first era of globalization or the first globalization. And I think you'd struggle to see anything that looked like a kind of like a common populist, to use that word, politics emerging across Europe and North America.
Okay, so if we try to answer the question of, do global political moods exist and are we experiencing a mood change? It sounds like the answer is somewhat nuanced, as we've described throughout this conversation. But like, is the answer basically yes, but we don't know what's responsible for it, and don't get too married to one particular mood because things can change quickly? I mean, what's the takeaway here?
So I would say I don't think mood is the right word for it. I think it's a story of fracturing, and mood makes it sound too coherent. Mm-hmm. But I think that the fracturing is producing some of these features in common. There is, I think, a common feeling of pressure, a build-up of pressure. I think it's, if I had to describe it, I think it's a function of relatively stable and successful systems. And I would include even the Indian system in that, coming under a kind of pressure they haven't come under for a generation or more. And so I think that feeling that we might be on the edge of something which is unpredictable, well, I think we're already in the unpredictable phase, but is unknown. And we're struggling collectively and imaginatively to think about what a democratic politics would look like if it did undergo a radical shift. You can kind of feel that in most places.
But what is that pressure? What is that pressure that you're describing on these democratic systems? Is it anti-globalism, anti-elitism? It seems like there's a pressure around the globe, but what is the pressure? What is the force?
I'll just say briefly, and then Helen, I mean, you know, the thing we haven't talked about clearly is technology and information. And some of this unquestionably, I think, is coming from a rejection, which in my lifetime, I think, is more acute than it's been in the past, of the idea that professional politicians know better, and that there is a kind of class of politicians, the familiar types who get elected, that they somehow know more or have access to the kind of information or better equipped to take decisions on behalf of voters. I think voters, for a range of reasons, and I've talked about this quite a lot on our podcast, not just because they feel left out or left behind, but often because we're living in societies where higher education, a college or university education, has become a qualification for up to half of age cohorts, where they look at politicians and they see, why are these people any different from us? And I do think something of what's driving that, and again, even in the Indian case, some of what's driving it is that there's a group of voters who look at politicians and think they're nothing like us, so why do they get to decide? And there's a group of voters who look at politicians and say, they're kind of just like us, so why do they get to decide? And traditional political parties are being caught on that, I think. And I think that may be happening in lots of places.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is probably a kind of a common legacy of 2008. And obviously, you have to exempt those countries like Australia that didn't experience the crisis in that way, in that it introduced some kind of, I don't know how to put it other than sort of existential fear into democratic politics, some sense that actually things could fall apart. And I think then the ways in which politicians and central banks ended up dealing with that, which in many ways kind of like ripped up the rules of the old politics, particularly by what central banks did of printing money. It seemed to, in one sense, it seemed to be something that was necessary in order to avoid something disastrous happening. At the same time, it's something that seems to create like infinite possibilities. So I think that there's a kind of that sort of restricted space that politics was in prior to the crisis. It's kind of ended really after 2008, and it created both new fear, new dread, and at the same time a sense of new possibilities that things that were previously off limits no longer were off limits. And I think then if you add the climate change issue into that on the existential dread side, you can see something else that's going on in terms of the psychological space in which politics is happening, not being what it was before. And I think it is also because the geopolitical world, the geopolitical order has shifted really quite profoundly since 2008, not just because of 2008, but it kind of aligns timing wise in that if you have this much disruption to the geopolitical order brought about both by China's rise, brought about by the increase in American power since 2008, what's going on in the Middle East, you simply are going to see some of that geopolitical disruption manifest itself into domestic political disorder.
It sounds like the answer is the sources of pressure are manifold, ranging from the financial crisis to technology to climate change, globalization, et cetera, et cetera. We will, I'm sure, continue talking about all of these things into the future. But before I let you two go, I do want to check in on the latest Brexit news, because a week ago today, Prime Minister Theresa May announced that she will resign in early June. This is after having tried and failed three times to get her Brexit deal passed through Parliament. I'll admit I was on vacation when this happened. Otherwise, we might have had the two of you on earlier as our resident Brexit experts. But now we have you. So I'll ask you, first off, why did May resign?
I think the fundamental reason was is because she lost the confidence of her cabinet, and the reason why she lost her confidence of the cabinet was because it became clear, you know, before the European Parliament elections had even taken place, that they were going to be absolutely catastrophic from the Conservative Party's point of view, and she invested the last remaining remnant of political capital that she had in these talks with the Labour Party in order to try to reach a common position so that the withdrawal agreement could be put back to the House of Commons, and she got absolutely nothing for her investment, and at that point she really had run out of road.
And I think she probably had run out of road a while ago. She has many qualities, one of which is an extraordinary dogged determination to keep going when there doesn't seem to be any point. And you know, the other reason that in the end she could no longer remain as Prime Minister is that she could not govern with this Parliament. The single central piece of legislation she needed to pass, which was some, whatever it would be, some form of legislation that could get us out of the European Union, was not going to go through this Parliament. And therefore the relationship between the executive and the legislature had broken down. And at that point under the British system, I mean, most people feel at that point under the British system, you go and you go a lot sooner than Theresa May did. Mm-hmm. In a way, the question is, how did she last so long?
So at this point, and I know this is probably the million-dollar question, but what does her resignation mean now for Brexit?
Well, in one sense, it changes absolutely nothing at all, because the basic position in terms of the EU's position on the withdrawal agreement and the inability of this, or the unwillingness, I should say, of this Parliament to pass the withdrawal agreement means that the next Prime Minister is, and indeed the Parliament that the next Prime Minister faces, has got exactly the same choices that it had when Theresa May was Prime Minister. I mean, the only thing that you can say is that whether a new Prime Minister changes the calculation of any of the domestic political players, or conceivably changes the calculation of the EU27 about dealing with the UK's membership or exit from the European Union.
And the euphemism that people use is a democratic event. This Parliament is not going to get out of this mess. It's stuck. It's trapped. So a democratic event will have to intervene.
What does that mean?
It could be a general election. It could be another referendum. It's people's way of saying, I'm not sure which it'll be, an election or another referendum. I think it's more likely to be an election than another referendum, because one of the ways this Parliament is stuck is it almost certainly wouldn't be able to legislate for another referendum. So a general election is coming, and again, under traditional unspoken rules of British politics, it probably would have come by now, but we have a fixed term Parliament Act, which is meant to hold parliaments in place for 5 years. And we have just had a democratic event, a weird one, the elections to the European Parliament, in which the two main parties were wiped out. And the other thing that Theresa May's resignation has done, the long build-up to it meant the focus was on the Conservative Party. When the leadership contest gets going for real, the focus will be back on the Conservative Party. In the hiatus, the focus is on the really terrible state of the Labour Party in this moment, because Labour did catastrophically badly in the European Parliament elections. Labour is as divided as the Tories are. And Labour's poll rating is falling as fast too. And so Brexit, in a way, it's taking a toll across the board now. And it's reviving parties that seem dead. So the Liberal Democrats, who even 6 months ago looked like they were never going to get back in the game, this morning are leading a poll for a vote in a UK general election. If you'd asked me 6 months ago, is that possible? I would have said, as I've often said recently, no way. And I'd have been wrong.
Mm-hmm. Where does the race stand at this point to replace Theresa May? Because short of, you know, a democratic event, a new election, it seems like, even if there is eventually that democratic event, there will be a new prime minister first. And what is the race like to replace Theresa May?
Well, I think that, you know, the favourite would seem to be Boris Johnson, mainly because as long as he gets into the top two, you would expect the members of the Conservative Party who get to choose the next leader from the top two to vote for him more than they're likely to vote for anybody else. But I don't think events as such can be ruled out where this is concerned, you know, like either. I mean, Boris Johnson has had a pretty checkered life. There's significant numbers of people within the Conservative Party and around the Conservative Party who think that it's simply intolerable for a man like Boris Johnson to be Prime Minister. Now, whether they'll be able to stop him getting on the second ballot is another matter. And it may well be that there are enough people in the Conservative Parliamentary Party who aren't that keen on the idea of Boris Johnson being their leader, but they're even less keen on the idea of someone like Dominic Raab from the ERG being their leader, so that they will swallow Boris Johnson, because it means that they've got no risk of ending up with Dominic Raab. So,
and what would that mean, ending up with him?
Well, basically, Dominic Raab is somebody who is absolutely committed in an unequivocal way to pursuing no deal. Now, he has no answer as to what would happen when his colleagues or some of his colleagues in the parliamentary party would, at the point in which he tried to pursue no deal, ensure that there was a vote of no confidence that would bring the government down. He doesn't have an answer to that, because there isn't an answer to that problem. And I suspect that what some Conservative MPs think is that there's anybody who can kind of like find a way of resecuring democratic legitimacy. Not actually, that's the wrong way of putting it, is using democratic legitimacy for Brexit to move things on, that the only person who could conceivably do that, either by calling a general election that the Conservatives won a majority at, or by winning another referendum, that Johnson is the only person in the parliamentary party who's capable of doing that.
The other thing that Dominic Raab would bring to British politics, and we've seen a bit of it already, is a kind of North American culture war aspect to it. He was asked the other day, would he describe himself as a feminist? And he said no. And it's really unusual for a British politician to talk like that. There's a sort of Jordan Peterson style to his politics, which is something new for us. The other thing I would say is the big mystery is, why are all these people standing to be leader? We haven't, Helen and I, or I speak for myself, haven't heard of some of them. What's going on? There are 12 candidates. There'll probably be 15 by the end of the week. The electorate in this case, to get to the final two who go to the membership of the party, is the MPs, Conservative MPs in Parliament. No one knows what they think except they know themselves. And I suspect inside that electorate, there is a strong feeling that Johnson might not make it. And then everyone's throwing their hat into the ring, because if you take Johnson out, then it's an absolute free-for-all. That's the only possible explanation for people trying their luck here. They may be wrong about that, because it's a secret ballot, and this is famously the most devious electorate in the world. But I think that inside the Conservative Party, they're persuading themselves that Boris might not make it. And as soon as they have that thought, they all then think, well, if he's not going to do it, maybe it'll be me. Now, it won't. You know, if he doesn't make it, it'll be... And there will have to be a candidate who stands for the more Brexit end of the party, and that candidate would probably win with the electorate. But you know, the thing to remember about this is that this is not the democratic event, because the first electorate is the 300-plus MPs, and then the second electorate is the roughly 100,000 members. these are two very skewed samples of wider public opinion. And there is still a very small risk that the Conservative Party will elect a leader, but that leader can't become Prime Minister, at least not for more than a few days or weeks, because they cannot command the support of the Commons. And under the British Constitution, the Queen, God help her, has to decide what to do next.
So it sounds like if I were to ask you what the likeliest outcome of Brexit at this point would be, you would tell me to F off or something like that, right?
Wait for the democratic event. Probably we've got to get through a general election, but as many people have pointed out, all of the signs of the fragmentation of British politics and the British electorate is that under our system, a general election will produce an even more hung parliament. Our system does also produce freakish results sometimes. If the Conservative vote, the right vote in British politics, fractures between the Brexit Party and the Conservative Party, the Labour Party could win on a very small vote share. If the left vote fractures between Labour and the Liberal Democrats, the Conservatives could win on a very small vote share. Strange things have happened. The next British general election will be really, really interesting.
I mean, I think the other thing that we should add in, though, is that the Scottish nationalist position has strengthened in the last few months. It now looks like the Scottish nationalists could go back to the kind of position that they had after 2015 in Scotland, whereas they didn't do badly in 2017, but they did much worse than expectations. Yet at the same time is that there are serious strains within the Scottish Nationalist party in terms of their position between the two people who have been the dominant personalities in that party over the last decade. So that isn't a particularly stable situation either.
Of course, we at 538 love interesting elections, so I'm glad you said that the next general elections will be interesting. On a final note, what would you describe as Theresa May's legacy as she departs in the coming days?
So with her, everything depends genuinely what happens, her sort of historical legacy. If Brexit happens, she'll look a different kind of prime minister than if Brexit doesn't happen. But in either way, I think what she'll be remembered for is a kind of curious personal dignity under intense pressure, but also there is no premiership that I can think of which can be defined in the way that this one was by a single issue. And on that score, it was a disaster.
I think that what her legacy might be doesn't just depend on Brexit, it depends on what she does next, because is that quite a number of our prime ministers recently have been, shall we say, seriously damaging their reputations by the ways in which they've behaved after that they left office. And if she stays away from that, if she stays in Parliament until the next election, she doesn't turn her years of public service into basically a means of making a lot of money, then I think that will in the end serve her well where history's judgment on her is concerned.
And just finally, as a sign of a kind of public servant she is, she could have quit last week, but she wanted to stay on because she had an obligation to host Donald Trump next week. I think a lot of British politicians would have thought that was a good reason to get out earlier.
All right, well, I think we'll leave it there. Thank you so much, Helen and David.
Thanks,
Galen.
David Runciman is the head of the Department of Politics and International Studies at the University of Cambridge. Helen Thompson is a professor in the Cambridge Department of Politics and International Studies, focusing on political economy. They host the podcast Talking Politics, which again, I strongly recommend folks go check out. My name is Galen Druk. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we will see you on Monday.